It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Once again, a bill legalizing the use of cannabis extracts to address certain medical conditions has made its way to the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. Last year, a similar measure passed the Senate but died in the House. Pennsylvania is one of seven states with pending legislation to legalize medical marijuana. Is the Commonwealth ready to make medical marijuana legal? I'm joined now by phone from Harrisburg by Allegheny County Representative Dan Frankel, who has indicated his support for medical marijuana. Representative Frankel, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Paul.
Also with us by phone from Philadelphia is Dr. Charles Cutler, Vice President of the Pennsylvania Medical Society. Dr. Cutler, thank you for joining us.
Paul, thank you.
And we can take your comments and questions today via email at esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Representative Frankel, let's begin with you. Are you in favor of the bill in the hands of House members, overwhelmingly passed by the Senate in its current form?
Yes, I am. As you indicated, it's passed the Senate with a resounding bipartisan majority, a repetition of what took place in the last session of the legislature, and it now sits in the House Health Committee, where, as you probably know, the chairman has been very reluctant, to say the least, to bring it to a committee vote.
And what has he explained his reasoning for being reluctant about this?
Well, I think, as you'll hear from the other person on the phone today, that I think there are folks who question the efficacy, where the research is at with respect to this, and there some of the medical societies are opposed, and some folks believe there needs to be additional research here done, which has been very hard to get done in this country because of the way the FDA categorizes marijuana. But we do know that there are thousands of studies that have been made across internationally, and we believe that there is a great efficacy towards using medical marijuana to mitigate some of these conditions and to relieve pain, and that decision ought to be left between a doctor and a patient, as it has in some form in 23 states who have legalized to some level the use of medical marijuana.
And before I get to Dr. Cutler, Representative Frankel, is it frustrating for you that this is sort of in limbo in the House at the present moment, that there is this reluctance to bring it up for a vote? Shouldn't it at least be brought up for a vote at this point and let the legislators decide?
Yeah, I certainly believe that. I've seen time and again where a powerful committee chairman gets a piece of legislation that appears to have broad bipartisan support within the General Assembly that gets held up because of that individual's position on the issue that doesn't reflect the majority of members. And in this case, Chairman Matt Baker is, at this point, an opponent of Senate Bill 3, and I assume, I believe, almost any form of legalization of medical marijuana.
All right, now to the reluctance of some to who say that it's not time yet to enact any kind of legislation. Dr. Cutler, what is the official stance of the Pennsylvania Medical Society regarding medical marijuana?
Paul, thanks. First, for your listeners, the Pennsylvania Medical Society, to my knowledge, is the largest medical professional organization in the state. And our board, and I think most physicians in Pennsylvania are in support of our position, which is the same as the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Psychiatric Association, the Academy of Neurology, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and a number of other what I'll call mainstream medical organizations across the country. So we're talking about the opinion of hundreds of thousands of physicians and likely dozens of mainstream medical organizations. And that is that we need more research before we make a determination whether or not marijuana serves us well, whether or not it's an effective agent to use for various conditions. Now, beyond efficacy, we also have to consider side effects and what the agent might do in terms of harm. And so we don't really have good outcome studies, as Representative Frankel alluded to. Marijuana has been classified as a Schedule I product for more than a generation, since 1930. So in the United States, there have been virtually no randomized, controlled, double-blinded studies to tell us whether or not marijuana works for various medical conditions. And again, if it does work, we also need to know, does it cause any harm? Because we've seen over the years a number of products that were quite helpful in terms of treating illnesses, but had such serious side effects that they were taken off of the market. So what the medical the Pennsylvania Medical Society has advocated for is reclassification of marijuana. It is now scheduled the same way as heroin. And I think most of your viewers would recognize that marijuana and heroin do not belong in the same category. So if the FDA, in their wisdom, would be willing to reschedule marijuana to a category where research could be done in the United States, well-controlled, double-blinded, randomized trials, I think we could get the answer whether or not the product works and what the harms are.
In the meantime, what do you say to the parents of children suffering from any number of diseases, sick children who want to see the passage of medicinal marijuana and who say that the drugs that are legal have harmful side effects? If there are drugs out there that are causing all sorts of problems for people, how do those weigh against what we're hearing about the side effects of medical marijuana? Some studies, for example, the Mayo Clinic stated in its August 25th, 2006, online article, Marijuana and Medicine, Consider the Pros and Cons. People widely used marijuana for pain relief in the 1800s. Several studies have found that cannabinoids have analgesic effects. In fact, THC may work as well in treating cancer pain as codeine. You know, when you look at the results of research that has gone on for years and you compare it to those side effects to what is already out there and legal, what do you say to those parents who are stuck for an alternative?
Yeah, well, of course, it's difficult for any physician to face a family, a patient, a parent with a child who's sick and say what we have available is limited and we're having difficulty controlling your symptoms. Illness is not responding to traditional treatment. The problem is that it is not helpful for any patient. It's not helpful for any child, and it certainly doesn't help any parent to administer an agent that doesn't help the illness. And there are well-documented case reports of parents going to a neurologist with their children saying that I've used this product, marijuana, and it's helping my child. And the reports are that the physicians, the pediatricians are seeing the children continue to suffer, continuing to have seizures, for instance, if that's what the parents are using the products for. There are reports of parents saying that marijuana as an oil is helping my child, but in fact, when the children are looked at with EEG studies, they're still having significant seizure activity. So
can I ask you,
the problem may be ongoing.
Doctor, if I can jump in.
The child still be sick, but the parents may not be helping the child.
If I may interject a question here, the studies that you're citing, are they coming from states that have legalized the use of medical marijuana? Where are the studies and these results coming from?
Well, there was a study reported by the Epilepsy Society actually recently at a national meeting about some benefit. And then when the study was looked at a little bit closer, there were examples or individuals that were questioning the report because there seemed to be bias introduced by those studies. So they are here in the United States. In fact, there is a ongoing study right now using oil, marijuana oil, and the results may be out soon. And if, in fact, it is a good agent for children with seizures, the medical society will be first in line advocating for its use. But getting back to the bill itself, the bill proposes using marijuana for more than a dozen different conditions, things as broad as diabetes. And there simply is no evidence that marijuana is a medical benefit or has medical benefit in diabetes. So we think the bill itself needs to be looked at very, very critically. I think the medical society is quite pleased with Representative Baker, who is the chair, I believe, of the House Health Committee, for putting the brakes on this discussion and listening to the doctors in Pennsylvania.
Representative Frankel, as you listen to some of the points and the concerns that Dr. Cutler raises, what are your thoughts? And
well,
go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, I believe, I understand the concerns, but there are things we do know about medical marijuana and cannabis in general, because it's been in use for centuries. There's no known lethal dose, which is not something you can say about other prescription medications that are used to relieve pain. The alternatives out there are highly addictive and abused and lead to the abuse of illegal drugs like heroin, opiates in particular. I've been involved in that issue and helped write the law that provides naloxone, the antidote to overdoses of opiates that first responders and families and friends now have access to. We don't need an antidote like that for marijuana. We know it relieves pain. We believe there are studies that have been done by the University of California, San Francisco, and McGill University that indicate that as much as 30% of pain control can be mitigated by marijuana as opposed to some of these much more powerful and dangerous drugs. In terms of other professional organizations, there is a considerable other opinion out there. And I've got dozens and dozens, but the American Nurses Association, the American Public Health Association, the Epilepsy Foundation, the British Medical Association, the California Medical Association, the California Nurses Association, the Florida Medical Association, the Medical Society of New York State, all have endorsed this. So there is, I think, clearly conflicting professional opinion within the profession about this, but I come down on the side of clearly something that... I wouldn't say that it's not a significant move, but at the same time, when you look at the alternatives out there for dealing with some of these conditions, extremely addictive drugs that lead to the abuse of opiates and some people to heroin once they can't get off, to look at a medication that has, as I say, no known lethal dose that has certainly, I think, inarguable pain relief issues. I mean, there's still debate with respect to seizures and so forth, but there seem to be many physicians out there who believe strongly that it mitigates the occurrence of seizures as well. 23 other states, as I said, have done this. I think it's time for Pennsylvania to do that. When you see the kind of bipartisan support, Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, who've listened to other people in the medical community and many, many patients out there who are suffering from many debilitating conditions, it seems to me that we ought to move forward. It's not like we're, a trailblazer here. As I say, 23 other states, the District of Columbia, and as I've listed, only a few of the medical organizations and advocacy groups who've endorsed this. I think that the downside is way outweighed by the potential benefits that could be offered by making medicinal marijuana available broadly in this community and regulated very strictly as this piece of legislation does.
That's Allegheny County Representative Dan Frankel, and we are also talking with Dr. Charles Cutler, Vice President of the Pennsylvania Medical Society, about the pros and cons of legalizing medical marijuana. A bill has once again, for the second year in a row, passed the Senate and is in the hands of the House. The governor, Tom Wolf, has indicated that he will sign legislation if it passes the House, but it may not come up for a vote. And Dr. Cutler, the research that has gone on for years with regard to medical marijuana, the other drugs that are out there that have been proven to have harmful side effects, what kind of trials were the manufacturers of these drugs put through before these drugs became available on the market? It seems that there is a much more rigid and harsher test that that proponents of medical marijuana are being put through than the purveyors of other seemingly more harmful drugs.
No, Paul, I don't think that's the case. But if I could, let me just offer a counter observation to Representative Frankel. One about overdosage, which the Senate author of the bill has also stated, similar to Representative Frankel, that you can't overdose on this product. And in fact, the active ingredient, THC, it's well known that you can overdose. And some of the signs or symptoms are drowsiness, euphoria, racing heart, memory impairment, urinary retention, slurred speech, low blood pressure. And I am just reading here from an FDA report on THC. And in fact, in folks with seizure disorders, pre-existing seizure disorders, an overdose can actually bring out an additional or a new seizure. So, and again, I've spoken to emergency room doctors, and there have been reports in Colorado where marijuana is easily available about increased frequency of emergency room visits for overdosing on marijuana. You can overdose. Secondly, it's also been proposed by the author of the legislation that instead of patients using narcotics, they'll be using marijuana. And we do have a narcotic problem in Pennsylvania, but there's no evidence for that. And we would, again, the medical society would urge research. I mean, it's possible different people will be using marijuana and will still have a problem with narcotic overusage, or we may compound the problem. People may be using narcotics and medical marijuana. We simply don't know. And thirdly, there are real concerns among physicians about the purity of the product. We're talking about a plant in Colorado, since marijuana is so easily available, the concentration of the active ingredients, THC in particular, has increased dramatically over the last few years. And the consistency of the product is a problem. And we need organizations that are producing the product to demonstrate that, in fact, there is consistency from plant to plant, because no physician can just give an agent and say, take enough until you feel good. That's a very dangerous way to practice, and we need to know how many milligrams or units, whatever, to prescribe for a given product. So I think there are some real problems out there.
Dr. Cutler, let me jump. Dr. Cutler, if I can jump in, just citing that Mayo Clinic study again, you know, one of the things that came up as a result of the Mayo Clinic's research is, as they state in their online article, cannabinoids appear to enhance the effects of opiate pain medications to provide pain relief at lower dosages. Wouldn't that be a less risky approach to mitigating pain and the side effects of things like cancer or some sort of brain disease?
Paul, it would be. And if that's the case, it would probably influence the opinion of the Pennsylvania Medical Society. And that really is what we are advocating for, more research, good research, double-blind controlled studies. What we have now are some European and studies that were done in other parts of the world, which don't really have the standards of American studies, and we have some anecdotal reports, meaning that they're just single cases or a number of cases, but they are not controlled, they are not blinded, and so they may be biased. And the Pennsylvania Medical Society, again, our position is that we need to know the evidence. We need outcome studies. We need to know that the product really works, or as you propose, by using it, less in the way of narcotics will be used. And we need to know that it's safe, that there are not side effects that are unanticipated. And if, in fact, the outcome studies are good and show effect and safety, the Pennsylvania Medical Society will be strongly in favor of a bill such as the Senate has passed. It's simply too early at this point to know.
Representative Frankel, I'm going to let you have the final word here as we're just about coming to time. But what are you hearing from your constituents in Pittsburgh?
I'm hearing that overwhelming public support for access to medicinal marijuana. And, just to counter some of the discussion we've heard earlier, is we know that over 1 million patients today nationally are using medicinal marijuana under the supervision of their physicians in accordance with their state laws, and it makes no sense to me to deny access to physicians and their patients for this option, particularly when, as you've identified and we've talked about today, the alternatives are clearly dangerous. The legal drugs to mitigate pain are cause addiction, cause criminality, cause people to die. And when you compare medicinal marijuana and its properties that we know mitigate pain, compare it to opioid uses, which are broadly used by physicians across the state, and in many cases they need to be. But to look at something as an alternative that would reduce the amount of opioid use nationally and therefore addiction and the things that come with that, I think makes enormous sense. I think we see other, as I said, medical societies across the state and medical organizations and advocacy groups have endorsed this. I'm not saying that people have this without going through their physician. A physician is going to have to authorize and supervise and do the maintenance with a patient who is utilizing this, and I think that's a great safety net. So in my view, it's another tool in the toolbox for physicians who want to use it and for the benefit of their patients, and I think it's time to do that. We're not being trailblazers here. 23 other states have done it. We ought to be among them to give providers the options to use with their patients who are suffering.
We've been talking about the pros and cons of medical marijuana. A bill is in the House at the present time, not scheduled yet for a vote, but it has passed the Senate overwhelmingly. That, again, a bill to legalize medical marijuana in Pennsylvania. and Governor Wolf has indicated he would sign it, depending on whether the House passes it. We've been talking with Allegheny County Representative Dan Frankel, also Dr. Charles Cutler, who is Vice President of the Pennsylvania Medical Society. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today for this discussion. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Coming up, we'll talk with the executive producer of the documentary Project 22, chronicling the journey of two combat wounded veterans across America to speak with vets who had contemplated or attempted suicide. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.
It's not about what you did or didn't do in Iraq or Afghanistan. It's about just not feeling right.
The lowest time was just thinking that I was all alone in it. Just thinking, well, all these other guys are fine. Like, why am I not the hard, tough veteran that's not affected?
Suicide deaths outnumber combat deaths now for 4 years running.
I realized that I did not care if I lived or died.
Would it be easier if I wasn't here? Well, yeah.
You know, I'm tired of this. I should have died in Iraq. I'm pissed at God that I didn't die in Iraq, so I'm just going to go ahead and kill myself.
One in six Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans had post-traumatic stress disorder last year.
We have a record number of 22 servicemen and women committing suicide every single day in this country.
I attempted suicide. I just quit.
That is a clip from the documentary Project 22. It takes its title from the sobering statistic, according to the Veterans Administration, that an estimated 22 veterans commit suicide every day. The film chronicles the journey of two combat wounded veterans who traveled across America to speak with veterans who had contemplated or attempted suicide, as well as researchers and healthcare providers. Joining us to discuss the film is Theo Collins. He's a law student at Duquesne University, a Marine Corps veteran, and executive producer of the film, which is being screened tonight for free at Google's Bakery Square campus. Theo Collins, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me back, Paul.
Last year, you were in the process of putting this film together when we spoke to you. How does it feel to have it finished?
It's a huge relief, not only for myself, but for everyone involved with the project. It was a long, hard year putting the film together. We were on a real short timeline to get everything done. Anyone who's made a full-length feature film or documentary can tell you that 1 year is an extraordinarily short period of time to put something like this together, especially for a team as small as ours.
And we cited the stat that it is estimated that 22 veterans commit suicide every day. And we heard in that clip that the number of veterans committing suicide who die as a result of suicide, that has outnumbered the total of deaths in combat, which is shocking, really. And so when did you become aware of all this, and then how did that lead to your embarking on this project?
Well, as is kind of discussed in the film, the inspiration for the film was the struggle of one particular veteran, someone who I'm close to, someone who the filmmakers are close to, who was struggling with these issues and did attempt suicide. That was really when I became aware of everything that was going on, the seriousness of the issue. And that's when Project 22 really started. There was a catalyst. There was a moment there. Doc and Dan, who are the co-directors of the film, they're the filmmakers, they had an idea for some sort of awareness campaign to raise awareness of the issue and increase prevention. Well, that grew into cataloging their journey across the United States and making it into something that'll last longer. My involvement came in. I'm close with Dan Egbert, one of the co-directors. We served in Afghanistan together in the Marine Corps. We stayed close afterwards, and being in conversations with him and learning what they were doing, I knew that I had to be involved. I came on a small role initially, sort of as a location fixer for the filming here in Pittsburgh. That developed into an associate and then executive producership with the film. And I now handle a lot of the business aspects, the behind-the-scenes stuff for the film.
And does it take the involvement of somebody who has gone through what a number of these veterans have gone through to really get it and to be able to approach them in a way that will allow them to open up, as they apparently have?
Absolutely. And that's where Doc and Dan, their unique experiences, both in combat and being back home, they're able to relate very closely with the veterans that we encountered across the United States and in our interviews with them. It makes it a lot easier to get them to open up about their experiences, what they've gone through, and then ultimately to find out what it is that brought them back from the brink so that we could then share that with the rest of the veteran community.
What has the reaction been? What has the response been to the film? It's been shown already in a number of places, and of course will be shown again in Pittsburgh tonight, and we'll give the details on that later. But what are you hearing from folks?
You know, the response has been overwhelmingly positive, even from before the film was released. Just people watching the trailer, following us on social media, kind of watching our timeline of progress, there was a lot of interest. And then once the film came out last October, which it premiered here in Pittsburgh, we're proud to say that, it's since screened in 12 other cities, and we have another about a dozen scheduled. Everyone who's seen the film, everyone who's talked to someone who's seen the film and learned about what it is about, has had an overwhelmingly positive response. We get a lot of people reaching out on social media, through our website, and other ways expressing how the message of the film and of the movement really struck them and how they wanted to get involved.
And is it surprising to people? I mean, when they see this, are people aware that this problem exists and the extent to which it exists, the number of veterans who come back and think about suicide or in fact do it?
Largely no. People have no idea until, you know, they either hear it from us or on national media, which it's been gaining prevalence in. That's part of the awareness campaign, is getting the media talking about it, getting not only military families, but the general civilian population talking about it. Largely before this, nobody really had any idea. What we've done is kind of shown a spotlight on the Department of Veterans Affairs, their own study from 2012, where they estimate that there's 22 per day.
And is something, you know, there's the conversation that you've created, but how is the problem being addressed?
Well, you know, we've talked to veterans who have, you know, they've tried the traditional routes. They've tried the traditional systems. But what we really wanted to find out and highlight with the film are the alternative solutions and methods that are out there and available for veterans. You know, if someone doesn't want to go through a medicated program or go through, you know, a traditional clinical treatment, we want to show them that there's other things out there that are available that are just as effective, if not more effective, and engage the interests of the veteran. Things like equine therapy, yoga therapy, art therapy, music therapy, all of those things are out there and available for veterans and have worked really well for a lot of people.
And is there also, just in addition to lack of awareness, a lack of treatment? I mean, part of it, I'm sure, is that veterans don't know what the options are. But you know, the Veterans Administration has certainly not gotten high grades for how they have dealt with this problem or even approached veterans who may be having difficulties. You know, what are the challenges on that front?
Well, that has been an issue, and fortunately, we're seeing a lot of private organizations and nonprofits that are kind of picking up the task. You know, there's private clinics and programs that are available for veterans that are funded, that the majority of them veterans can take part in for free, just by nature of being a veteran. Yes, the VA has had their issues, you know, recent years and for many decades. But we're seeing that the veteran community is really sort of circling its own wagons. and they're helping others in interesting ways. The VA is getting better at it. Even here in Pittsburgh, they have an art therapy clinic here, I believe, at their Aspenwall campus. But like I said, a lot of the things that we feature in the film are private organizations.
We're talking with Theo Collins. He's a law student at Duquesne, a Marine Corps veteran, and executive producer of the film Project 22, a documentary that chronicles the journey of two combat-wounded veterans who traveled across America to speak with vets who had contemplated or attempted suicide. Theo, I'm curious about your own experience. When you came back, I believe you served in Afghanistan. When you came back, what was it like for you? What was your adjustment period?
You know, I'm happy to say that I was very fortunate when it came to my readjustment. I was a full-time student up in New York State at the time that I deployed to Afghanistan. I was a member of the Marine Corps Reserve, and our unit was activated in 2010. I took a leave of absence between my junior and senior years of college, and for a year we did the pre-deployment and then deployment. But when I came back, I was really able to jump right back into finishing out college. I had a really good support system around me of family and friends, and my professors. They were all very understanding and made the transition very easy. I found that getting immersed in my work of being a student and working towards going to law school, that kept me busy and that kept me good.
And what, I mean, not having served in the military or in combat myself, I can't imagine what those experiences are like. But is that what causes these problems, the depression? Is it the trauma of war? Is it witnessing death? Is it inflicting harm and death on others? Combination of all?
You know, for every veteran, it's different. For every person who served, their circumstances and their own personal nature, it's different. And likewise, the causes for it, the treatments for them are different for each person. What works for one person isn't necessarily going to work the same for another veteran. It's not cookie cutter. That's why we encourage, you know, the viewing audience to learn about and engage in some of the different methods that are available and to find the one that works for them.
And is it veterans across the generations of wars? I mean, because, you know, certainly we hear about the Iraq and Afghanistan vets. These are the most recent wars. These are the men and women who are returning. But does it go back to Vietnam and World War II? And did you talk to some of those in Korea? And did you talk to some of those veterans also?
It absolutely does. You know, through the generations, it's been called something different. In World War I, we had shell shock. Now we call it post-traumatic stress disorder. That was really a term that was coined in the 1980s. And in our research and in the filming, we had the opportunity to speak to a fantastic psychologist and researcher here in Pittsburgh, Dr. Roger Brook, over at Duquesne University. And his research has been into the many different ways that PTSD, as we know it now, has been viewed and treated throughout history. His research goes as far back into the ancient tribal cultures in South Africa. He has studied George Washington's personal memoirs and notes and determined that it is almost certain that George Washington, while he was the president, suffered from PTSD.
That's fascinating.
It is. It is. Dr. Brook here in Pittsburgh, he was a man who, when we spoke to, changed everything about how we were going about this project. And he is an influence for upcoming projects as well. But, you know, as we go around in the communities, we are speaking to veterans from prior generations, Vietnam veterans, Korea veterans, World War II veterans, and they're sharing that, you know, they suffered from a lot of the same things, all the same things that the younger generation of veterans are. It was handled differently in those times. I can speak to my own family, my grandfather, who served in World War II in the Pacific. My uncle told me that when he was growing up, my grandfather had a lot of issues and would have trouble sleeping and would wake up. So it was prevalent in previous generations, and we're seeing that, and we are engaging those people.
Well, it's certainly the work that you have done, it sounds marvelous, and for people that are interested in seeing this documentary, Project 22. It'll be showing today at Google's Bakery Square campus. And the showtime is when, Theo?
It's at 5:30 tonight for people who have registered. We've actually sold out this screening as of yesterday morning. But I can say that if anybody in Pittsburgh is interested in viewing a screening of Project 22, we have an interesting setup where those people can arrange for a screening at a theater or organization.
Theo Collins is a Marine Corps veteran, served in Afghanistan, a law student at Duquesne, and he is executive producer of the documentary Project 22. It screens today at Google's Bakery Square campus. Theo Collins, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris looks at the neighborhood of Crawford Roberts. That's next here on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
You'll see them getting down and with their cameras and taking pictures.
Mary Rafferty has lived on Roslyn Place for 65 years. From her dining room windows, she often sees people wandering along the small residential street, located just off Ellsworth Avenue, gazing up at the towering sycamore trees or the shoulder-to-shoulder brick houses. But most often, they walk with their heads down.
Tourists, I guess, and not used to maybe the neighborhood or Shadyside.
Roslyn Place is made of wood. Not the street's 18 homes, but the street itself. It's paved with wooden blocks, and has been since this cul-de-sac neighborhood was built. It's the city's last wooden street, one of only a half dozen remaining in the United States. At one time, wood was regularly used to dampen the sound of horse traffic and metal-wheeled wagons, but not in 1914, when Thomas Rodd built Roslyn Place. It's unclear why Rodd chose wood for the street, but he did.
Well, let me show you before I start talking about this. This is the end of it right there.
That's Augie Cardillo, a stonemason who, in 1985, was hired by the city to repair Roslyn Place.
The wood was deteriorating. It was there for a lot of years. We tore it out, yeah.
They re-poured the street's concrete foundation. New gas and water lines were laid. Cardillo pulls out a yellowed article from the Post-Gazette dated August 2, 1985. In the picture, Cardillo sits back on his heels, preparing to split a wood block in half.
There's the work you have to do. You have to cut it like that with a chisel and a hammer on your knees all day.
Cardillo and five or six other men, he's not exactly sure, cut and fit 26,000 blocks into the 250-foot-long street. The repair took more than 6 months and $70,000.
It would look beautiful when it's all completed, yeah. Nice and new-looking. I got a piece laying out here yet, an old scrap piece. See, that's pretty old, but, you know, I mean, that's it.
The wood block Cardillo places on his trash can is a weathered green-black, flaking apart. It's slippery from the rain.
We have about 1,060 miles of streets, and in conjunction with some roads or streets we take care of for the state, we're up around 1,200 miles.
Mike Gable is director for the City of Pittsburgh's Department of Public Works. He says Roslyn Place is well-known in the department, though no significant repairs have been made since 1985.
That's 30 years ago. And it's still looking pretty good. So that's actually a lot better than some of the asphalt and concrete streets we have.
It's not unassailable, however. If the first 71 years were rough on Roslyn Place, the last 30 have been no cakewalk. The Gable says it's a character street.
The fact that we have at least one street like that, you certainly want to keep that.
Despite the Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation plaque at the entrance to Roslyn Place, the street isn't protected by a historic designation. It remains vulnerable to ease, convenience, and asphalt. For 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
UPMC is proud to support 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Considered part of the Hill District, Crawford Roberts is a collection of neighborhoods bordered by the downtown area on the west, the Strip District and Polish Hill on the north, the Bluff Uptown on the southwest, and Oakland on the east and southeast. As part of her monthly focus on neighborhoods, contributor Rebecca Harris, director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University, is here to look at Crawford Roberts in part one of her special look at that neighborhood. Rebecca Harris, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great. It's nice to see you, Paul. And it's beautiful outside, and we have spring and soon summer, and a great time to look at neighborhoods.
And so we'll start now with Crawford Roberts. And in part one, you're going to look at the historical background, which kind of fits the theme of this segment.
Absolutely, it does.
What do you have for us?
So the early origins of what is today known as the Hill District started and began as Farm Number 3, Paul. It was owned by the grandson of William Penn, sold two centuries ago to General Adamson Tannenhill, a Revolutionary War veteran, for $20 an acre. Pretty good deal, huh, Paul? In the late 1840s. And then Thomas Mellon bought a tract of farmland on the slopes nearest the city, and he subdivided the tract into smaller city-sized plots. And this really began the Hill's development as a settled community. And as we know, with the great expansion of the population after the Civil War and the introduction of the trolley service, many residents began to go and seek homes away from the city. So the next wave of people coming into that Hill District, Crawford Roberts area, were immigrants from Europe. Jewish immigrants started about the 1870s and 1880s. And then a number of people came from Italy, the Syrians, Greeks, and Polish people. And African American people came about 1880s and the years leading up to World War One.
Right, and then the Great Migration, as it's called, really began.
Really began, and at that point, there was a large migration to Pittsburgh. And as you and I both know, one of the major turning points in the history of this area, which has been viewed as when the city in the 1960s displaced a number of residents and businesses in the Lower Hill District to build the Civic Arena. And the people who were displaced moved into East Liberty and Homewood, Brushton neighborhoods, causing sort of this middle-class family flight. And so it really has changed the tenor of that neighborhood a lot. And we see that. So,
well, effectively kind of driving a stake through the heart of the neighborhood, because, as much as many of us enjoyed the Civic Arena, what it did to the working and thriving community that was there was devastating.
It was very devastating. And so what was viewed as allegedly going to be a very strong economic development really did turn things around. And as we're talking about the history, I would be very remiss and not mentioning in the 1930s and 40s when you had amazing musicians like Ramsey Lewis and Oscar Peterson and Cannonball Adderley and others who entertained in the Hill District at the old Hurricane Lounge or at the Crawford Grill, because you would once walk down Center Avenue and hear the bands playing blocks away. I mean, it was really a centerpiece of music and life, and what an amazing location.
And that's where we would find the Crawford Grill, right?
Absolutely.
And of course, as August Wilson famously documented, sitting outside because they couldn't afford to go in, they sat outside and listened the day that John Coltrane showed up.
Right.
And we will talk more about Crawford Roberts and get into next week in part two of your discussion, the demographics of Crawford Roberts, some of the key points of interest, the main businesses in the area. And as always with these segments, you'll provide us with some interesting facts that we don't know about Crawford Roberts, won't you?
I will be delighted to, and you'll have to wait till next week to find them out, Paul.
Well, Rebecca, we appreciate your making it in here as always, and especially because, you know, you're well, you're on crutches.
Right, I'm
but
on
you
crutches.
Came in here.
I'm soothing a broken tibia, but I'm marching along, Paul.
You and John Kerry. Thank you so much for being with us, Rebecca, and we'll look forward to part two of your segment about Crawford Roberts next week.
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program, you can revisit those segments and past segments on our website, wesa.fm. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.